This is not the time for the Alaska State Legislature to be timid. And it's not about the issue, it's about the separation of powers.
The legislature sues Governor Walker over Medicaid expansion. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, August 18th. Good evening, I'm Ann Hillman. Also tonight, bringing Alaska's GPS maps into the modern age.
Mars was better mapped, more recently mapped, and more accurately mapped than Alaska.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. Alaska Pacific University offers personalized education with real-world experiences to prepare graduates to be leaders in their communities. Details at 1-800-ALASKA-U or alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
Four people are missing after heavy rain triggered a series of landslides in Sitka early this morning. Recovery efforts have been suspended while officials wait for the affected slopes to stabilize. KCAW's Rachel Waldholtz reports.
Those missing were all likely involved in the construction of several new homes on Kramer Avenue, about 2 miles from downtown Sitka. The slide in that area destroyed one of the new homes entirely and at least damaged another, though the full extent of the damage was still unclear Tuesday afternoon. Neighbors have reported a second slide on the northern end of Kramer Avenue in an area that has not yet been developed. The area remained unstable Tuesday afternoon, and officials suspended search and rescue efforts over fears of further landslides, though rescuers did manage to pull a dog alive from the debris. The neighborhood below the slide has been evacuated. Heavy rains triggered what now appear to be at least 3 major landslides and a handful of smaller ones in Sitka on Tuesday morning, prompting the city to declare a state of emergency. A slide across Sawmill Creek Road heavily damaged the administration building at the Gary Paxton Industrial Park, Sitka's former pulp mill site, about 8 miles from downtown. No injuries were reported, but the building was evacuated along with bunkhouses belonging to local fish processor Silver Bay Seafoods. A third slide was reported in a more remote area on Harbor Mountain. Harbor Mountain Road has been closed above the first gate at the bottom of the hill. Sawmill Creek Road has been closed beyond Silver Bay Seafoods as crews work to remove the debris. The National Weather Service recorded over 2.5 inches of rainfall in the 6-hour period between 4 and 10 a.m. Tuesday. The flash flooding prompted temporary trail closures at Sitka National Historical Park. Flooding in the parking lot of the Sitka Laundry Center on Halibut Point Road opened a sinkhole the size of a large van in the pavement. 2 propane tanks on the edge of the sinkhole have since been removed. In Sitka, I'm Rachel Waldholtz.
A legislative panel has voted to sue Governor Bill Walker to stop Medicaid expansion. The Legislative Council made the announcement after a closed-door meeting in Anchorage this morning. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
The Legislative Council voted to spend up to $450,000 on legal assistance to fight Medicaid expansion in court. Before the vote, Republican Senator Charlie Huggins made the case for the lawsuit.
This is not the time for the Alaska State Legislature to be timid. And it's not about the issue, it's about the separation of powers. So I firmly urge members of this body to support the motion.
Last month, Governor Walker announced he would expand Medicaid starting September 1st. The legislature failed to vote on his Medicaid expansion bill during this year's regular or special session. Only one lawmaker voted against the lawsuit, Democratic Representative Sam Keto of Juneau. He noted that several legal opinions supported Governor Walker's decision to expand Medicaid on his own.
And I am concerned about spending money in our current budget times to actually perform an action that could cost the state money.
Medicaid expansion would offer federal health care to low-income, childless adults. The federal government will pay 100% of the cost until 2017. After that, the state's share of the cost of the program will gradually increase, but never amount to more than 10%. At a press conference following the Legislative Council vote, Governor Walker said he was surprised and disappointed in the legislature's action.
I stand firm on my decision. It was the right thing to do. I'm not wavering a minute on this. This is the right thing to do. Alaskans deserve nothing less And this does not push me in another direction whatsoever.
The Legislative Council is bringing in a Washington, D.C. law firm to challenge Medicaid expansion. Lawyers with Bancroft PLLC have argued against the Affordable Care Act in cases before the U.S. Supreme Court. Senator John Coghill, a Republican from Fairbanks, voted for the lawsuit. He says the lawyers will focus on getting a judge to issue an injunction stopping Medicaid expansion from going forward on September 1st. He says if an injunction isn't granted, the lawsuit is unlikely to be effective.
I think that we'll push it, but by then, by the time the process works, we'll probably be in a regular session. So at that point, it becomes probably the damage already done, and then how to unravel it probably is not going to happen in the court system.
About 40,000 Alaskans would qualify for Medicaid expansion. The Walker administration estimates about half that number would sign up in the first year. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
An effort to remap Alaska celebrated its halfway mark today during a sky-breaking ceremony in Anchorage. KSKA's Monica Gokey has more on what the project means for the state.
Alaska is 57% mapped. That's the milestone celebrated today at the FedEx hangar in Anchorage. Interior Secretary Sally Jewell gave the keynote by telecast, and a handful of GIS bigwigs flew in for the event. Nick Master DeCassa with the Department of Transportation is one of the project's leaders in Alaska.
When this whole thing started in 2006, I found out that Mars was better mapped, more recently mapped, and more accurately mapped than Alaska.
A lot of the current mapping data used in Alaska is 40 or 50 years old. It was collected using manual cartography techniques that are now obsolete. One of the big drawbacks to some of that old data is that it isn't always accurate. Here's Master DeCassa describing the situation to Talk of Alaska host Steve Heimel on this week's program.
There are some ridge lines we've seen that are close to 1,000 meters off.
It's not
as bad as we originally thought, but it's bad. We are seeing valleys that are horizontally displaced by half a mile.
You probably get the picture that these kinds of mapping errors are a very big deal if you're a pilot. For example, if you're flying through mountainous terrain and your flight path suddenly gets socked in, you really want your GPS device to be accurate. The new data being collected with this mapping initiative is accurate within millimeters. $41 million have been spent on the project so far, and that money is coming in from a multitude of different state and federal agencies. The data collection process is expensive. It involves a technology called IFSAR. Kevin Gallagher of USGS explains.
IFSAR is Interferometric Synthetic Aperture Radar. It's essentially a radar, but by projecting it at the ground and measuring the reflectance back, gives you a very highly detailed elevation map.
In addition to aviation, the high-quality data set also has significant implications for mineral development and resource management purposes. This data, Gallagher says, is also going to become even more significant as climate change begins to reshape the North.
Because the data we're collecting now is going to serve as a baseline to understand the changes that are occurring out on the landscape.
Gallagher hopes the remapping project will be finished within another 2 to 3 years, which will bring Alaska's maps on par with those in the lower 48 and on Mars. In Anchorage, I'm Monica Gokey.
Chinook salmon continue to swim up the Yukon River, the latest indication that the long ailing run may have turned a corner toward recovery. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
An Alaska Department of Fish and Game sonar counter near the Canadian border at Eagle continues to tally king salmon. It's near the end of the run, but counts have remained pretty good, anywhere from about 800 early in the month to nearly 300 August 10th and 11th. That's well down from the over 3,000 counted daily during the peak of the run a month ago. But state fish and game biologist Stephanie Schmidt says the extended strength of this year's Chinook return is surprising.
We're actually at just over 83,000 Chinook salmon. That's the most that we have passed across the border since this project has been in operation since 2005.
The number is more than predicted by computer models and lower river return assessments, and well in excess of a border passage objective of 55,000 kings. This year's return is the second in a row that appears to show movement toward rebuilding a run that once averaged over 150,000 Canadian origin fish, but has tanked in recent decades due to overfishing and suspected environmental factors. The downturn resulted in extreme fishing restrictions Schmidt expects will be relaxed next summer.
We're still going to make sure we're meeting escapement goals, But it does mean that there is hopefully more fishing in the future for Yukon River fishermen.
Schmidt cautions that management of next summer's fishery will hinge on what's predicted by computer models that try to account for complex factors, including the age classes of fish expected to return. She says a salmon research project near the river mouth, also being used to predict run strength, has been seeing more young Chinook. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, from wage earner to homeless and back again.
This is the part of the story where I gotta tell the truth, okay? This is my big blip. I was in Dutch Harbor, Alaska, working as a longshoreman.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow. The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Anchorage's two largest hospitals are appealing the state's recent allocation decisions in hopes of building more emergency room beds in the next several years. The Alaska Dispatch News reports that Providence Alaska Medical Center and Alaska Regional Hospital have both filed appeals accusing the Department of Health and Human Services of making groundless assumptions about costs and the best interests of the public. Too many emergency room beds can push up healthcare costs, so Alaska, like most states, has laws limiting the capacity of emergency rooms. In July, Providence, Alaska received permission to add 8 beds, 6 fewer than it requested. Alaska Regional's proposal to add 2 freestanding emergency rooms in South Anchorage and Eagle River was denied in an effort to prevent unnecessary ER costs. The appeals will be heard by an administrative law judge who will make a recommendation to the state's health commissioner. Monday afternoon, Amber Batts was sentenced to 5.5 years in prison after pleading guilty to sex trafficking in the second degree. The defendant was running the sex trade business Sensual Alaska that served people around the state. Batts connected sex workers with clients who were pre-screened for safety concerns, and then she took a portion of the fee. She has already 2 felonies on her record. State Assistant Attorney General Adam Alexander prosecuted the case. He says the case was not about the morality or legality of prostitution.
Our hope in prosecuting broader sex trafficking enterprises is to create a safer environment for individuals who are caught up as workers in that trade, in an environment where those people feel comfortable disclosing when they're being victimized. And unfortunately, our experience, again, on the ground here in Alaska, is that more often than not, the people who are working in the sex trade are victims of exploitation.
Alexander says many participants in the sex trade are vulnerable and have experienced trauma. But sex trade worker advocate Tara Burns says members of the industry are being prosecuted for actions that make the sex trade safer.
So we work indoors instead of, you know, out on the street. And that is called having a place of prostitution now, which is felony sex trafficking in the third degree. We share clients and we communicate with each other about clients to see if they're safe. Have you seen this guy? Was he safe? And that is now called, you know, a sex trafficking ring or a prostitution enterprise. And that's felony sex trafficking in the second degree.
Burns has worked in the industry for 20 years, and her organization, Community United for Safety and Protection, is lobbying to change the state's laws. More than 30,000 people have signed an online petition in support.
We are asking for the Alaska legislature to repeal the new sex trafficking laws. We want to be able to go to the police and report crimes like sex trafficking without having to worry about being charged with felonies now instead of just prostitution.
The laws passed in 2012. The human rights group Amnesty International recently adopted a resolution supporting the decriminalization of consensual sex work, saying that it will make it safer for the workers. People don't usually plan to experience homelessness. Life just takes unexpected turns. But for some guests of the Brother Francis Shelter in Anchorage, like Mike Hindman, the experience leaves them with more hope than anything else. When I spent the night at the shelter late last month, he greeted me and other guests at the door.
All right, anybody and everybody who walks inside, please come in, line up on the right-hand side. How you doing?
It was an unusually calm summer evening. 26-year-old Michael Hindman was monitoring the entrance area to the shelter and checking for contraband like weapons or alcohol.
Anything inside your pockets I can see real quick?
Burly and tall with a goofy smile, the name of an ex-girlfriend tattooed in delicate script on his arm, Hindman never saw himself in a place like Brother Francis. He was young, strong, making good money.
In the back of my mind, I thought, you know, like, why are people homeless? Like, I've always had a job. Why don't people work? And why don't people do this? And, you know, maybe I didn't have compassion or sympathy at first.
And then he made a mistake.
This is the part of the story where I got to tell the truth, okay? This is my big blip. I was in Dutch Harbor, Alaska, working as a longshoreman.
Hindman got involved with drugs. He was busted for buying narcotics for an undercover cop. He pleaded guilty to a felony and went to prison.
I learned my lesson right off the bat. My first 30 minutes in jail, I realized this is not for me. And then besides that 30 minutes, I had another 18 months to learn the same lesson, thinking, this is definitely not for me, you know?
As part of the plea deal, he gave the state everything he owned. He was released this spring in Anchorage, a town he had never visited and where he had no friends. He walked out with nothing but purple prison underwear, donated clothing, and a quarter in his pocket. After sleeping rough for a couple nights, someone told Hindman about Brother Francis. He began volunteering as a door monitor in exchange for secure housing at the shelter and help finding a job. Hindman says it completely changed his perspective.
I no longer pass judgment when I walk by somebody. It's more just what can I do to help, you know, because whether the person, maybe they are an alcoholic or maybe they do have a temper problem or maybe they have some kind of flaw, but I think all of us do. And more what I try to worry about now is that person cold?
He says working at the door lets him see people's lives turn around. One day they're tired and stressed, and a few weeks later, they have a job and are looking bright. That's his story, too. He was recently hired as a cook on the North Slope, but during his off weeks, he'll be back at the shelter, helping out and saving money to rent a place of his own. Hindman sees beauty in the echoey concrete halls.
Seeing people with nothing to their name, but they give everything they can to the next guy that also has nothing, you know. Maybe, you know, they got two jackets and it's raining outside. They'll give somebody their only jacket, you know. I know people that make $100,000 a year that probably wouldn't let you borrow their jacket, you know.
He says he stays positive and hopes it helps others stay that way as well. From the Urban Affairs Desk, I'm Ann Hillman.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
The Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence.
Broken hips and head injuries can have life-altering effects, especially for older adults. But no matter how old you are, it's important to be physically active to prevent injuries. Activity can also increase your strength, balance, and can be done at any age. Ask your healthcare provider about activities that will improve your health. Learn more about starting a new activity at injuryprevention.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Alaskans voted in 1998 to define marriage as in the state constitution as only between a man and a woman. Now that the U.S. Supreme Court has invalidated that definition, Alaska and the entire country has marriage equality. To some, it may seem like things are changing fast. As KTOO's Lakhidra Chavis reports, Alaska's fight for gay rights began half a lifetime ago.
In the course of Alaska's legislative history, there have been six bills to outlaw sexual orientation and gender identity discrimination. In Anchorage, there have been at least three ordinances. They've all failed. The fight may have begun in 1975 when the Alaska State Human Rights Commission took a formal stance that sexual preference should be included in the state's non-discrimination policy. House Bill 125 was introduced in 1987 during the AIDS epidemic. The commission director, the attorney general, and the governor all supported the bill.
Just something that seemed to me it was time to make some noise about, I guess.
That's former Democratic Governor Steve Cooper. He introduced the bill less than 2 months after taking office. He had served in the Vietnam War and made a friend who was gay.
They served just as well or better than anybody, than other people, you know.
Cooper can't remember why exactly he introduced the bill, but cites that personal experience as a possible reason. Old files also suggest Commission Director Janet Bradley asked for his support.
But as a general principle, people shouldn't be discriminated against any more than you should be able to discriminate for racial reasons.
Cooper's friend died from AIDS years later. House Bill 125 never made it out of committee. Janet Bradley left the Human Rights Commission in 1988. During the last decade of her career, she had taken an aggressive approach to more inclusive legislation. After she left, Paula Haley became the commission's director. She's still the director now and hasn't touched the issue. In 1989, Identity Incorporated, an LGBT advocacy group, published a statewide survey documenting the experiences of Alaska's lesbian and gay community, including issues of discrimination and health. Janet Bradley ended the report's foreword with a call to action. This report then becomes our challenge, for if we believe that our vision of Alaska is marred when discrimination exists, we must commit ourselves to eliminating sexual orientation discrimination. In 2012, researcher Melissa Green published her final report on a survey on LGBT discrimination in Anchorage through Identity Incorporated. It was a few weeks before Anchorage voted on Proposition 5, a sexual and gender identity anti-discrimination measure that failed. She says the report received a lot of criticism.
It has important things to say. I hope that people might still read it, but I'm done. I'm done. I'm off on my own life.
She's burnt out and says she's kind of bitter.
It ate up a lot of my life and a lot of my time. It had, I wouldn't say exactly zero impact, but pretty close to that. Nobody really cared. Outside the LGBT community, nobody really cared.
In 1986, the Anchorage Daily News interviewed a gay man working at Identity Incorporated. He was collecting violent and homophobic voicemails the office received for the organization's research report on gay and lesbian discrimination.
Because through the AIDS crisis, we started finding out how important our relationships were.
That's Jay Browse, the man in the ADN's article.
We started finding out we had no rights. We were denied so many ways.
He said he knew of couples who'd been together for decades, and if one of them would become ill or die, often their relationship meant nothing when it came to hospital visitation, burials, military honors, and home ownership.
And how do you explain that to people? It was a potent, virulent form of discrimination.
During the same year that ADM published his story, he interned with the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force in D.C. Browse and his now husband, Gene Dugan, applied for their marriage license in 1994. The controversial act eventually led to the 1998 constitutional amendment defining marriage. He paid for being a prominent gay figure in the 80s and 90s in more ways.
Yeah, I felt the prejudice, the discrimination, very personally and directly.
In 2006, he and his husband moved to England, where he has dual citizenship. In September, he'll travel back to Anchorage to clean up the last few bits of his life in America before leaving for good. And Juno, I'm Licky Dershavis.
On Saturday, a Ahuna microbrewery is opening its doors to serve the village a variety of craft beers. Kegs used to be practically disappear around the same time tourists did. Now fresh pints are guaranteed through winter. KTOO's Elizabeth Jenkins has more.
Todd Thingvall and his business partner, Dan Kane, have been working hard to renovate a 100-year-old house on pilings above water, the site of the new brewery and taproom. Both left good jobs to start the business, and Kane says his kids have asked if he's having a midlife crisis.
There's been a lot of sleepless nights. You know, I'm sitting in Anchorage at my house there, and I had a good life. And there was a lot of mornings I'd be awake, 4 o'clock in the morning, and sitting there going, have I lost my mind? Is this really what I want to do?
He's been homebrewing for about 20 years. They met each other through their wives.
Dan had beer, so I instantly liked him, and we hit it off ever since.
And Thingvall liked the beer. He pitched Kane the idea of opening the Ahuna Brewery. They invested about $400,000 and are living upstairs. The long-term plan is to move the tanks to another site. But for now, they're on the patio above the water. Usually, stainless steel fermentation tanks are labeled 1, 2, 3.
We decided, let's stay with the Southeast theme, and we went with Kita, Humpy, King, Sockeye, and Coho. So the 5 species of salmon. Whereas the king is the big 7 barrels, so.
They're cooled by a refrigeration unit that runs partially off solar panels. Electricity can be expensive in Ahuna, so the panels could pay for themselves in a little over a year. on the bottom of the King tank, they show me a brewer's secret.
You're very lucky to see this. It's called a sample valve, and it allows you to take samples or actual drinks out of a vessel. So this is our pail, which is the first beer that we made here.
Looks like you're filling me up.
There you go.
He hands me a frothy golden glass, and I take a sip.
It's really good. It almost tastes like a finished beer. It kind of has that little bit of a bitterness of the pail, but kind of sweetness.
Exactly. I'm a big Cascade hops guy, and that's loaded with Cascade hops.
With no connecting roads, the Pacific Northwest hops and brewer's yeast is shipped using FedEx. Engvall and Kane says it can be nerve-wracking, waiting for the delicate ingredients to arrive, most of which needs to remain temperature-controlled. It travels from Seattle to Juneau, then over to Hoonah by a small plane. A few weeks ago, their yeast was overdue.
One great thing about a small town, even the postmaster, she knew exactly what I was looking for, and it came in Saturday after their closing hours, and she called us and said, hey, it's here, and waited there for us to come down and pick it up.
They'll serve Pale Ale, IPA, and Hefeweizen. A Pilsner and a Stout are also in the works. Production will be about 500 barrels a year, and some of the kegs could be distributed to some of Southeast's smallest communities, like Gustavus and Elfin Cove, maybe eventually making its way to Juneau. What Kane says they're really looking forward to the most is experimenting with ingredients like Hudson Bay Tea, a medicinal plant that grows in the muskeg.
When it first hit your palate, it was more of just this light, clean, crisp beer. And then as it hit the back of your palate, that's when that tea just kind of came alive.
It can be tricky getting FDA approval for ingredients that are locally sourced. But both Kane and Thingvall say they're up for the challenge. They want Icy Strait Brewing to reflect the community.
Hoonah has a slogan, and I believe it's something to do with the little place with the big heart, and it's true. The people here are wonderful.
And now it has a micro brewery to match. In Hoonah, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Rachel Waldholtz in Sitka, Deanne Bross in Fairbanks, Lakitra Chavis in Juneau, and Elizabeth Jenkins in Hoonah. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Gokey is our web editor. And I'm Ann Hillman. Have a lovely night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Spinard Builder Supply. For more than 60 years, SBS has helped Alaskans build from ground to roof to everything in between. Spinard Builder Supply is here to build with you.
And by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. Alaska oil and gas have a huge impact on all of us, but how much do you really know about them? At akoilandgas.com, you can take an oil and gas IQ quiz and get the facts from reliable sources. This message sponsored by the Alaska Oil and Gas Association. Alaska Pacific University is still accepting applications for the fall 2015 semester for their business and counseling psychology undergraduate programs. APU offers affordable education, small class sizes, and life-friendly schedules designed to support professional goals. More at 1-800-ALASKA-U or alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.